Turmoil between Syria and Egypt. A lot of changes. King of the North, King of the South. That's what a big part of this chapter is about. And some of the battles that are contained therein, and some of the relationships between the King of the North and King of the South. Pretty interesting stuff. And the main takeaway from that we talked about on Sunday is just that pretty much every detail that we find here in Daniel chapter 11, at least up until this point, we can find clear historical evidence of these things come into play. And like I said, in very fine detail, the people did what this chapter says that they were going to do. We can attach names and dates to certain things. So we get down into verse 19 here. We're talking about Antiochus the Great. He shall turn his face back toward the fortresses of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found. So we talked about the idea of him being conquered, and he had to surrender all of the cities that he had conquered. And then part of that was this he had to pay money, restitution, that's the word, for some of the things that he had done. And for part of that, his son Antiochus the Fourth, or Antiochus Epiphanes, who's going to be the main player in the last half of this chapter, is actually taken as a hostage to Rome. And then we see that Antiochus the Third, or Antiochus the Great, was then later killed by his own men. So it talked about he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found. His own men killed him because he was trying to find ways to pay Rome the money that they had demanded of him. And so he was plundering a temple, and they didn't like that, so they killed him for that particular act. So then that leads us right into verse 20, where we'll pick up for tonight. It says there in verse 20, Then shall arise in his place one who shall send an exactor of tribute for the glory of the kingdom, but within a few days he shall be broken neither in anger nor in battle. So we understand, again, Antiochus III is now gone. And the idea here is this Seleucus the Fourth. We've talked about a lot of Seleucuses, a lot of Ptolemies last week. He becomes the heir. He was the older son of Antiochus the Third. So Antiochus the Fourth is in prison in Rome. Seleucus the Fourth takes over in his place. We understand that the debt that was owed was about 1,000 talents per year minimum to Rome. And so he begins the process of trying to raise that money. Like I said, Rome had already taken pretty much everything they had. So he's trying to raise that money. And he sends out Heliodorus, who was basically the tax collector. And he's going out into all ends of the kingdom, and he's just taxing the people to death, trying to raise this money. And then eventually, after about 12 years, Heliodorus ends up poisoning him. And so that was the end of his reign, not a very long stint there. So then that brings us again to the big part of this chapter, Antiochus IV. We talked about him in great detail back in chapter 8. Remember the goat with the horns, the small horn that sprouted out of the other horn? That was Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes. And so the next several verses are going to be dedicated to him. And we'll talk about basically four different things here that in the first part of that, which is his gradual rise to power, and then his war with the king of the south for that supremacy that he desired. Verses 28 to 32 goes into more detail about his persecution of the Jews, which we talked about that in some detail back in chapter 8. This goes into that a little bit more. And then finally, verses 33 to 35, kind of the effect of that on the Jews. So we'll go into that a little bit before we finish out the chapter. So let's jump right in. Verses 21 through 24. That's a little bigger than I thought it might be. It says there, he will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honor of royalty. He will invade the kingdom when its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. Both it and a prince of the covenant will be destroyed. After coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully, and with only a few people, he will rise to power. When the richest provinces feel secure, he will invade them and will achieve what neither his fathers nor his forefathers did. He will distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. He will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. So we start out here talking about Antiochus IV, and the main thing that we're picking up in these verses is his character, which was again alluded to back in chapter 8 in more detail here. And we understand right off the bat that he was a contemptible person. not anybody that you wanted to have dealings with. He was a deceitful, a sly, cunning person, and he's the type that could get you in trouble real quick. You partner up with this guy, he'd stick the knife right in your back in a heartbeat. And we see that play out in a couple of the scenarios that we'll see here in this chapter. But it talks about he was not given the honor of royalty. And the idea there we see is that he had no right to the throne. It was not rightfully his. He kind of steals it. And kind of contrast that with when we talk about Solomon in 1 Chronicles chapter 29. It says there that God bestowed upon Solomon this royal splendor, this royal majesty. And so we kind of see that contrast of God putting somebody in a position versus somebody kind of stealing a position. We understand, though, this all plays into God's ultimate plan. But he had no right, no real right to the throne. In fact, his nephew, who was Demetrius was the son of his brother, Seleucus IV. And remember, Seleucus IV, we just talked about, was murdered by Heliodorus. So that would have been the rightful heir to the throne. Antiochus, again, is in prison in Rome, held hostage. And somehow, we don't know all the details around this, but somehow he works this deal to where he can be released and Demetrius can be brought in his place. I don't know if that was because Demetrius was the rightful heir. The idea there was, though, that he kind of promised to come get Demetrius out once he was able to pay the debt, which he did not do. So that's kind of the first dealings we see here of Antiochus IV, kind of weaseling his way into the throne. It talks about in the verses we just read that an overwhelming army will be swept away before him, both it and a prince of the covenant will be destroyed. I thought it'd be worth just taking a quick minute to look at this, because there's a large number of varying opinions about this prince of the covenant. Who is that? What is that? What does that entail? And so I just thought I'd share with you a few of the ideas. One of the main ones that comes up is that it had to do with the priests, the rulers of Jerusalem, because we talk about the people of the covenant. Later in the chapter, it talks about Antiochus setting his heart against the covenant or the people of the covenant. So that's one of the main theories there, is that it had to do with the priests, the rulers of Jerusalem. Apparently, Antiochus IV makes a covenant here with Onias III to basically put him in as the high priest. So he makes this barter type of a deal. And then he turns around and he goes back on his word and he gives the high priesthood to someone else. And so maybe that was part of what was being talked about here. But the interesting rebuttal to that is that Onias III was actually murdered by someone else. Antiochus had nothing to do with that. Antiochus didn't know anything about it until after it was over. So that lends to, or you know, maybe this was not the right theory here. Matter of fact, when Antiochus heard about the fact that Onias had been killed, he brings in the murderer and has him put to death. So he kind of retaliates against the one that murders Onias. So maybe not. One of the main theories here is that it's Demetrius, because Demetrius was truly the rightful heir to the throne, and Antiochus kind of steals that from him, kind of like the birthright with Jacob and Esau. And so he was truly the prince, and by all rights, he should have been the next ruler. So maybe that's the prince of the covenant that we're talking about. And then lastly here, another, and there's more than this, but the last one I put on here is the idea of Ptolemy VI, who was a ruler in Egypt, the southern kingdom there, king of the south. He tries to come back and claim the dowry. Remember we talked about on Sunday that there was that relationship where the king of the north sent, I forget which Antiochus or Seleucus it was, I'm not going to go back and look, but one of them sent Cleopatra down to Egypt to marry one of the Ptolemies so that they could have this relationship, this treaty, so to speak. And remember how that backfired on them, that she ended up partnering or siding with her husband. But there was a dowry involved there, that she was going to become his wife, and there was also going to be this great sum of money sent along with that. And so we understand that Ptolemy VI tries to claim on that. He says, all right, I'm ready for the dowry. And Antiochus refuses to give him that dowry, which erupts into a war. And so maybe that's part of this Prince of the Covenant that was taken down with that. Ultimately, at the end of the day, whoever it was, whether we know who that was or not, it tells us about the character of Antiochus. He was not a good guy. And we're going to see that play out even more as we continue on. So we see some of the things that he did that are alluded to in these verses. He deceived the richest provinces into feeling secure. So he goes in kind of as a friend, and we've seen that in some of the others that we talked about on Sunday, trying to make these kind of false treaties. But he deceives the richest provinces into thinking that everything's okay, that he's on their side. And then he invades and takes over. Part of the way that he did that was that he was kind of unique in this, that he shared the spoils of his other conquests. He would go to people, kind of this whole Robin Hood type thing. He would, you know, give the things that he had taken from other countries to the people and get them to like him. And then he would turn around and invade and take their land and their property as well. Speaking of that kind of, a strategy on his first trip to Egypt, when he goes down, he only takes a few men with him. He goes down and tries to be like a friend or be like a guardian to the young Ptolemy the VI. And so he takes a few men with him. It's not a great battle, but he takes his few men and he sets them up kind of in the strongholds of Egypt. And then he turns around and claims that Egypt is his, basically. And then later we see some war coming from that. But that's kind of the way that he operated. So we kind of see, again, into his character and the way that he operates. So on to verse 25. I'm sorry, questions, comments. I'm flying, I know, but I'm trying to get done for Matt's sake. But if we do have a question or comment, I'll stop. All right. So verse 25. We're going to talk about this war now that's going to come up. With a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. The king of the south will wage war with a large and very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. Those who eat from the king's provisions will try to destroy him. His army will be swept away and many will fall in battle. And the two kings with their hearts bent on evil will sit at the same table and lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will still come at the appointed time. So we see a couple things come up in these verses that ought to be quite familiar to us. This idea that the end will come at an appointed time, that's going to come up to play more in the latter part of this chapter, but we've seen it all throughout the book of Daniel. When it's time, it's time. And it's going to happen no matter what you do, what kind of treaty you try to make. And also we see in verse 26, those who eat from the king's provisions will try to destroy him. We've seen those that eat from the king's provisions on more than one occasion, right? The very beginning of the book, you know, Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they refused to eat basically from the king's table or from the king's provisions, his dainties, his delicacies. They wouldn't do that. And then later in the book, we understand that Daniel was eating from the king's delicacies because he said that he had been fasting and had not eaten any of that stuff for some time. So here we see a scenario where those that were eating from the king's provisions actually played a part in bringing him down. Obviously not the Babylonian king, but this is completely different. But we see the same kind of imagery there. So let's talk about this war just a little bit. Antiochus finally gets the courage and the strength up after he weasels his way into the kingdom, and he starts to develop this following. Again, started out small. Started out, we talked about in some previous chapters that he was a small horn. That horn that sprouted out of the goat's horn was a small horn. He was not powerful. He was not big. He did not deserve recognition or honor or power, but he starts building it. He starts gradually accumulating these people. And eventually he gains the courage and the strength to actually go attack Egypt. So Ptolemy the VI, we've already talked about, was the ruler of Egypt at the time. He brings a large army and he fights against Antiochus. But he fails, and we understand his own followers, those that ate his food, actually plotted against him. So they kind of worked with Antiochus, most likely. He probably got to them and bribed them with some of the spoils of his other battles. So Ptolemy loses a lot of his army, and so that's when we see again this half-hearted treaty. And it talks about them sitting across the table from each other, and lying to each other's faces. So I mean, we can understand that imagery, right? I mean, we. Nobody likes to be lied to, and especially somebody lies to your face. We talk about that being a bold kind of a thing. You know, lying is one thing, but to lie to my face, you know, I get more offended about that. Well, these two men sat across the table from each other, and they're both doing the exact same thing. They both are trying to figure out a way to beat the other one, but for the time being, they're willing to make this kind of half-hearted treaty, a semi-pseudo treaty, just to be able to get by. So we see the record of that again in great detail. History records the same kind of things for us. Questions, comments through those few verses? Okay. So then we get into verse 28. Then the king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the holy covenant. He will take action against it and then return to his own country. At the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different from what it was before. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him and he will lose heart. Then he will come back and vent his fury against the holy covenant. He will return and show favor to those who forsake the holy covenant. His armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. Then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. With flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. That's a long section. And there's a lot going on in that, so we'll spend some time going through that. So Antiochus goes down to Egypt, as we just talked about in the previous verses. He beats Ptolemy the VI. He comes back with the spoils of war. He returns to Syria with that. But remember, what's right in between Egypt and Syria? We talked about it on Sunday. Israel, Palestine, Gaza Strip, whatever you want to call it, the Holy Land, Promised Land, that is right on that main thoroughfare. And so as he's going back up to Syria, he stops off around Jerusalem, stops off there in Palestine. And so this is when he begins to persecute the Jews. Again, we've seen prophecy of this before in the book, and now we're really getting into the heart of it here in this chapter. He's on this high, so to speak. He's just won his first real battle. He's finally arrived, I guess, in his mind. He's somebody. He didn't have any power, didn't deserve any power, but he's finally got it. And so he comes back into Jerusalem, and this land that had been fought over for a long time, several hundred years even at this point, is right in between the two countries. So it's that borderland, it's that land that they both wanted to control, and it's basically occupied by the Jews at that point. So it says there the language again, his heart was set against the Holy Covenant. So again, we talked about the Prince of the Covenant earlier. We're going to talk more about the people of the covenant as we go. But we understand his heart was set against it. And the idea there is that he wanted it gone. It didn't help him in any way, so he needed it out of there. His heart was set against it. And the idea is it was not just against the people of the covenant. It was more the covenant itself. The whole idea of this higher power, the idea of this kingdom that his forefathers, all the way back to Nebuchadnezzar even, had kind of admitted that God was, you know, the God of Israel was the God. And he despises that fact. There is nothing greater. As a matter of fact, he's basically an atheist, which I guess you have to be to do some of the things that he did and to kind of put himself in the position that he puts himself in. But we do see later that he does set up another God. We'll get into that. But he's basically atheistic in that there is no real higher power because he is the high power in his mind. He's, you know, pulling himself up by his bootstraps, so to speak. And so he's on this high. He comes back into Jerusalem and he starts to persecute the Jews. But that's just the beginning. It's going to get much worse here in a couple years. He's going to go back and he's going to attack Egypt again. But the first time he comes back through Jerusalem, he's coming back from a victory. And he does some things to the Jews there. But when he comes back the second time, 2 years later, he attacks Egypt, but he's beaten. And it goes into some of the detail there. The ships from Kittim or Chittim, we understand that to be Roman influence there, and with Gaius Papilius Lanus, famous historical story again that we can turn and we can read in secular history about, and it's the idea there that Antiochus is saying, you know, he's defeated, he's turned away, he's told to go back to his land, and he basically asks for some time to decide what he's going to do. I want to figure out what the best course of action is. What am I going to do now, since you're not going to let me go down and beat up on Egypt anymore? And Gaius here basically literally draws a circle around him in the dirt or in the sand. And he says, don't get out of that circle. I mean, it's like something we do with our kids, right? We put them in the corner. Don't move out of that corner until you've changed your attitude. That's what he does to Antiochus, this guy that thinks he's this great, powerful leader. He literally draws a circle around him and says, don't step out of that circle until you have the right answer. And so he decides he has no choice but to go back to his homeland. He cannot pursue Egypt anymore. He's outpowered, outnumbered, and basically defeated at that point, discouraged and frustrated. And that is when he comes back into Syria or into Jerusalem and Palestine the second time. And that's when he comes back with a vengeance. He takes it out on the Jews. I forget the exact numbers, and so many different sources I've been looking at for this. I know I saw it, and I went back through every book that I thought I had looked at, and I couldn't find the exact numbers again. But I know it was 160,000, and I think, don't quote me on this, but I think it was he killed 80,000. He took 40,000 with him back as prisoners to Syria, and then he sold 40,000 into slavery to other nations. But it was 160,000 total. It may have been he killed 40,000 and took 80,000. I forget exactly. But 160,000 people basically are drastically impacted by Antiochus' rage as he comes back again into Palestine this time. One thing that we do understand is that he showed favor to those who would turn their back on Judaism, the ones that apostatized. He favored them. He didn't take his anger out on them because he was trying to get them onto his side. If they were willing to renounce God, that's what he was all about anyway. So we start seeing, actually in the next couple things that we'll talk about, we start to see people that are kind of on the fence. They're kind of believing in God and waiting for God to do the things he's going to do, but they're really not sure he's going to do it. We start seeing them abandon ship. So going on into the things that Antiochus does, that again, this persecution of the Jews, he places this armed guard in the temple. I know we talked about this briefly in chapter 8, but he defiles the temple. He goes into the holy place himself. He sets up an armed guard and basically forbids anybody to go there and worship. He's changing, he's taking away their religion. He's stripping it out from under them, which was, you know, everything that, their whole lives revolved around that. Probably that guard in the temple probably included some of those apostate Jews. They knew the place, they knew the people, and likely that he put some of them into that position. He removes the golden altar and he removes the candlestick. Again, this is all, I don't read the first Maccabees and all that, but all, I mean, that's the source where a lot of this stuff comes from. So I'm giving you quick references of the things that we have secular history telling us this stuff happened. So he removes the golden altar, he removes the candlestick from the temple, abolishes the daily sacrifice. Remember we talked about that, because they were asking how long until the sacrifice would be restored in chapter 8 when we talked about that. So he removes that, he abolishes the daily sacrifice, he sets up an idol's altar. We'll talk about that a little more later on, but he sets up this altar. Matter of fact, he sets up his own altar to a foreign god on the altar of burnt offering. So we talk about this desolation or the abomination that causes desolation, this idea of basically putting his altar on top of God's altar, because that's how powerful he thought he was and how little regard he had for the Lord. He changes the temple. Instead of being the temple of God, he starts calling it the temple of Jupiter Olympius, which was supposedly the god that he... the one god that he kind of gave some honor to, although he shunned almost all others. Basically this idea, he's trying to make himself the focal point of all religion. If you're going to worship anything, it's going to be me, because this is, you know, the way that I'm treating this supposedly, you know, the god of Israel. It's how I'm treating his stuff and nothing's happening. So again, we kind of have this proverbial line in the sand. Are you a Jew or are you not? Are you going to serve God or are you not? And it separated a lot of the weaker Jews at this point. Again, jump ship, said, I'm out of here. They've already seen how Antiochus treated those that were willing to give up and run. And so many did. and left only a small remnant of those that were the true faithful ones, which we're going to talk about in the next couple of verses, which I better hurry up and get to. Verse 33, those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. When they fall, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. So we're going to talk about kind of what this did to the Jews. So it talks about here, the wise will instruct many. The idea being that the ones that were truly faithful, the ones that had been around and had seen these rulers come and go, these kings of the north and kings of the south and their dealings with one another, they did what they had to do, what they needed to do. And they tried to teach as many people as they could what truth was and what falsehood was and what right was and what wrong was and which side of this that you need to be on. And so the application, obviously, to us is the same, that if we know what we need to do, no matter what's going on around us, we need to be that wise, that group of wise that will try to instruct many, not just hold it in and just try to, you know, make the best for our own selves. But we understand that they're going to fall for a short time. What are they going to fall to? They're going to fall to Antiochus' torture. It was pretty specific there. They will fall by the sword. They'll be burned. They'll be captured. They'll be plundered. This is the kind of thing Antiochus did. And again, secular history goes into greater detail on that. Women were killed for having their children circumcised. He would kill the women if they did that. And then the children that they had circumcised would be hanged. That was the way he operated. He pulled no punches. Man, woman, child. We'll get into that a little bit more as we go forward. Talks about this little help. When they fall, verse 34, they will receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. Well, this little help most likely is the Maccabean revolt. And you can read again about that in secular history. And I don't claim to be an expert on any of this, much less the Maccabean revolt, because I can't turn and read about it really anywhere. So, but I understand that that was, Mattathias was kind of the patriarch of that, and then he had five sons. Judah, or Judas, depending on how you read it, was one of the key players there. The other one, I didn't write it down. But anyway, there was another one that was another key player, but they turn against Antiochus, and they actually killed some people that were in key positions of power. And it basically starts this whole kind of internal civil type war. And they're trying to salvage Judaism. They're trying to save the Jews and the Jewish style of worship. And ultimately, they succeeded in that. The worship was preserved. It was restored. The daily sacrifice was eventually restored. They went through destroying pagan altars, different places. And it talked about that they would be joined by some that were not sincere. That was, again, some hypocritical Jews that kind of jumped on the bandwagon, but as soon as they saw a way out, they turned and ran as well. And ultimately they were about to be wiped out, most likely. There was a Seleucid army that was headed to squash this revolt. With the death of Antiochus IV, at some point they were called home, and so they never actually made it there to do everything that they were intending to do to the Maccabees. But so the idea there is that you've got these Jews that are going through all this stuff, the worship being changed, the temple being defiled, they can't do their normal things like circumcising their children, so on and so forth. But they had this little bit of relief in the fact that there were some people that were bold enough and strong enough to stand up against it, and kind of felt like they were turning the tides a little bit. So you can understand those that were falling by the sword or being burned or captured or plundered, they're seeing some of these things take place. It was a strengthening, encouraging thing to some of them. Let's see. So again, yeah, we had that ultimate division of those that are truly faithful and those that were not, because of some of these things, the ones that joined themselves to the Maccabees and then again turned and ran when things got a little bit tough. Okay, part two, in the final few minutes that we have, And I'm not going to get into chapter 12, but just kind of one of the ways that the chapter or the book is outlined talks about Antiochus kind of going into the first few verses of chapter 12, so I just left it here. But verses 36 to 39 is this rising of the hostile king. Again, Antiochus setting himself up above all powers, including God and especially including God. And then the last few verses of the chapter, again, some controversial stuff in here. You can look at it a few different ways, and I'll talk about a few of those as we go. But basically, the end of Antiochus the Fourth is what I think we see there in verses 40 to 45. So let's jump on in. Verse 36, the king will do as he pleases. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god and will say unheard of things against the God of gods. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed, for what has been determined must take place. He will show no regard for the gods of his ancestors or for the one desired by women, nor will he regard any god, but will exalt himself above them all. Instead of them, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god unknown to his ancestors. He will honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. He will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god and will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. He will make them rulers over many people and will distribute the land at a price. Okay, so again, a lot in here. Not going to be able to cover it all. We'll do the best we can. But we see the idea again of him doing as he pleases, exalting and magnifying himself above every god and saying unheard of things. Remember we talked about earlier in the book about, you know, speaking boastfully and saying things, you know, that were unheard of. Not to be confused though with the horn of, which animal, which beast was that? I'm drawing a blank. Which one am I thinking of, Matt? Not to be the horn that had the eyes and the mouth. That's not the one I'm talking about. Or is it the one I'm talking about? Let's just forget everything I said for the last 10 seconds and we'll just stick to my notes. How about that? Some take this idea that there's a transition here in verse 36 that, actually there's transitions all throughout the chapter and there are a lot of different takes on where the transition actually takes place. Some will say that right here in verse 36 is a shift. We're not talking about Antiochus anymore. We're talking about, the Roman kingdom, the Roman Catholicism, the papal kingdom. Some even, you know, go as far as Antichrist here. Many refute that, but that's one idea. Again, I'm just pointing it out as something to think about if you want. Perhaps there's a dual meaning here. Perhaps we're talking about Antiochus because that's who we've been talking about this whole chapter, and maybe there's some allusion to this Roman papal kingdom that is to come. Maybe so. I'm going to go on the assumption here for the sake of the next few points that we're still in the realm of Antiochus. And you want to disagree with me on that, we'll talk about it later, but we don't have time to argue it all out here tonight for sure. Because we see here we see again in history of Antiochus doing these things, dishonoring God. We see Antiochus making himself above all other gods and taking down again the altar or putting his altar on top of the altar. Disregarded the God of his fathers, something that was a bit unheard of at that point. No regard for women and children. There's a few different ways to look at this. The verse said in the NIV that he will show no regard for the God of his ancestors or for the one desired by women. Some translations, it sounds more like he had no desire for women. Not sure exactly what the original language here is intended to say. Best I could gain from all the things I was looking at was it was more of a sign of his character that he had no regard for women and children. Again, going back to the idea of the circumcision where he killed the women and hung the children just for doing that one spiritual ritual, so to speak. It talks about honoring a god of some translations forces, some translations fortresses here. And the interesting thing there is that we do struggle historically to pinpoint exactly who that's talking about. We had gods of heaven and gods of sun and gods of stars and, you know, all these different gods. there wasn't really this Greek mythological God of forces or God of fortresses. So there's a little bit of speculation when we get into this. But again, going back to the earlier assumption that it was this Jupiter Olympius, as he started to call the temple, which again, it was a new god to the Syrians. That was not anything that they had ever been a part of, as he brings in a little bit of this Greek influence and sets this up in place of, the temple of, or the altar of the burnt offering there and the temple. That's a very brief snapshot of everything that's in there. Questions, comments on that part? Okay. Let's roll on. We're getting down to the last few verses here. At the time of the end, verse 40, at the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. He will also invade the beautiful land. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. He will gain control of the treasures of gold and silver and all the riches of Egypt with the Libyans and the Cushites in submission. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to his end and no one will help him. Remember, we've talked about the end of that before, this idea that no one will help him. It's, again, he didn't really deserve to be in power, and he's going to go out of power kind of on his own, so to speak. So it gets a little tricky here. Again, another transition here in verse 40 for some is that, we were still talking about Antiochus up until this point. Now we're not. Now we're talking about something completely different. I'm going to stick to what I said, and I'm going to go with the position that this is still talking about Antiochus. Now, I'll say that to say that there is still, I think, some double meaning here on a couple things, especially when we get over into chapter 12, which, again, I'm going to defer to Matt. But I think ultimately chapter 11 is about Antiochus. I think it's all about him and the things that he did and the impact of what he did. But what gets tricky about this is that in the things that are recorded for us here in the last few verses of chapter 11, we don't have as clear-cut historical evidence for every single thing and dates and times and places like we do for the first part of the chapter. So that's where people get a little hung up on it, and they say, well, we can't be talking about Antiochus because everything else we've talked about was so precise and so accurate, and I mean, just can't argue that it was Antiochus Epiphanes. The last few verses, you can kind of argue that because, again, some of it does not appear, at least so far, does not appear in secular history. Because one of the things here is it indicates that there was another battle between Egypt and Syria. The idea of at the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle and the king of the north will storm out against him. So it indicates that, again, from the Ptolemaic dynasty there, they attack against Antiochus, and he goes at him in this fierce battle, which we don't have a record of anything exactly like that happening. And one of the interesting things here is that we don't hear of any great slaughter in this particular battle, but it was more of he was after the money kind of thing. And that kind of does sound a little bit like Antiochus, although he was also a very brutal brutal ruler that did slaughter many up until this point. So again, hard to pinpoint exactly, was this him, was this not, and why don't we have a record of it in other places. It talks here about Edom and Moab and Ammon being delivered for their assistance against the Jews. They were the ones that kind of threw in with Antiochus and kind of turned their backs on Judaism, and they were willing to help him in some of his earlier conquests. And so the idea of letting them go does seem to fit here. That we saw how he dealt with those that were, if they were willing to turn their back on God, then they were okay in his book, and he was willing to let them live. So that does kind of sound like Antiochus. And then the idea here that he's called away. It talks about specifically, I'm sorry, I skipped over one thing I didn't put in on the slide, but it talks about invading the beautiful land. Again, promised land, Palestine, Jerusalem, that area. But it says he will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. He will also invade the beautiful land. Many countries will fall. He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. But verse 44 is what I was looking for. But reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. So we kind of see again this same kind of an idea where he's in this battle and he's doing whatever he wants to do, and then he's called off. Kind of like Rome turned him away once before as he was trying to plunder Egypt. Now he's in Egypt and he gets these reports that most likely his homeland is either under attack or about to be under attack. And so he's got to drop everything and he's got to get home. And remember the last time he came back through Palestine, he was pretty mad and he took it out on a lot of people. This time, to the nth degree more, because he finally made it there to do what he wanted to do, and it's not going to happen. So he's going, at this point, the idea was to wipe Judaism off the planet, which he's already been working to that end to some degree. But I think that's what he had in mind. He's going to, again, completely destroy the Jewish nation as a people. One of the problematic things for some here is that it talks about him pitching his tents between the seas at the beautiful holy mountain, yet he will come to his end and no one will help him. You can read that and say that, well, he dies in Palestine. He's on his way back to Syria, but he pitches his tents there in the beautiful land between the seas, that being the great Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea, and he never makes it back home. Well, secular history again will tell us that he died in Syria. So some people have some issues with this. But then kind of the rebuttal to that is that most likely he pitched his royal tents. This is not like a tent that you and I would sleep in at the campground, but these are huge, massive royal tents. And there would have been the huge main tent, the royal almost, I mean, it's like a portable palace type tent. Think about it that way. Oh, wow, that clock's wrong. And then there would have been a lot of other tents around it for his people. So the idea is that maybe he pitched his tent there and he let his generals continue in battle, and then he travels on and never actually makes it home. Sorry, I thought we had another minute. I was going to tell you a couple other ideas about that. Unfortunately, you have to read them for yourself. But I appreciate your attention. I'd love to say I enjoyed teaching this class. I'm struggling to say that, but it has been a challenge.